a.m. at the Tao Event Center in Portland. Tanya Stevens is an influential reggae artist who began releasing records in 1994. Opening the show will be Cat and Roots Revolution plus DJ Margo Hartenfeld. There will also be food and other refreshments. Again, that's Tanya Stevens in concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tao Event Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. This is an 18 and over show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As life is much too quick for your hurry, and there's too many problems, so tell me, oh, why worry?
Baby, you understand me now.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we have a guest on the phone, and his name is Dr. Peter Bomer, a professor at the Evergreen State College and longtime, very longtime committed activist. Peter, how are you doing tonight?
Great, Adam. Good to talk to you. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah, excited to have you on tonight. There's a lot to talk about, and we'll see how many bases we can cover. Can you just kind of give us a brief, just talk a little bit about how you got involved with things and how maybe that led to some of the more recent work that you've been doing inside some of the Washington prisons?
Okay, yeah. So I'm originally from back east. And in the 1960s, a lot through the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, I got very involved in Students for Democrat Society and other organizing, and began to see a lot of problems in the United States systemic rather than the war being a mistake or the country would just by itself right issues of racism. And I've been active since 1967 in a lot of movements in solidarity with various struggles around the world, like Palestine, Central America, South Africa, Vietnam, Cuba, Puerto Rico, etc. I moved to Olympia in 87 to teach at the Evergreen State College. I got a dissertation in the doctorate in economics focused on the political economy of racism. I've lived here for over 30 years in Olympia and have been active in various groups here. Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, trying to combine justice and peace issues, and doing a lot of economics education in the community, and teaching political economy at Evergreen. And through Evergreen, I was put in contact with a person named Kamanti Carter, who's been a leader of the Black Prisoners Caucus, and has been in the prison Clallam Bay in northern Washington. And the Black Prisoners Caucus invited me to share some of my political economy analysis and workshops with prisoners, and through them, and also a Hispanic or Mexican group and a prison Coyote Ridge, I've done maybe 8 or 9, usually 2-day seminars with a group of people, usually connected to Evergreen, where we go out and do workshops with prisoners. They don't get credit for it, but there's a lot of interest in doing these workshops. And I've done some Juneteenth and other talks there also.
That's great, Peter. One thing that's interesting in this conversation is that some of the folks that you're talking to and working with consider themselves as political prisoners. And I think we just mentioned that the Jericho movement had the 20th anniversary commemorative event just this last weekend. And of course, folks probably are maybe familiar with the Jericho movement doing political prisoner work because they've heard it on the show or just familiar with it. And so there's we're in this place in time, right, where we're seeing, you know, people who, well, A, you know, continue to get jailed for their activism, and then B, these folks that Jericho has supported and that you've supported and you yourself have been a jailed activist and been in touch with many of those political prisoners yourself, or you knew some of those people maybe when they were before they went inside and things of that nature. So can you talk about what that whole piece entails?
Okay, so let me try to deal with some of that. So I would say going back to the late 60s, when there was a lot of major, you know, activism, still continues today, but maybe not quite the level of the late 60s, there was also a lot of repression. I worked in various coalitions with the Black Panther Party, who did some really, really good work, but also suffered a lot of repression. And I remember working originally around Bobby Seale, who was on trial for murder, was one of the founders of the Black Panther Party. And then when I moved to San Diego, where I lived in the 70s, I worked with the Panthers, but I was also involved with other people in supporting George Jackson, just an amazing writer and organizer in the California prison system, who was eventually killed in San Quentin. So it always seemed to be going back to the 70s that we're building movements for liberation and justice in the United States. Supporting political prisoners is really important. I, because of my activism, was a victim of COINTELPRO and had some pretty serious repression in terms of many death threats, being shot at, and spent a small amount of time in prison, about 6 months total. And this was mainly in Chino, California, and earlier in Massachusetts. And just really, from my short time in prison, just really impressed by the kind of intelligence, knowledge people in prison had, both in my experience in prison, my short time in prison, the 6 months plus, in these workshops I've done here. I would say so many people I've worked with, for the most part, were not political prisoners to begin with. I would call them more like, you know, economic prisoners, prisoners of a, you know, a racist capitalist system. Mm-hmm. But many people, through having a chance to read, think in prison, almost in spite of the prison, have really developed a pretty strong consciousness about, you know, where they don't excuse behavior they've done. Many people are, I know, either for robbery, or even many of the people in Washington were in a gang and, you know, maybe were convicted of murder when they're very, very young, you know, before 20 years old, and have served often 10, 20, 30 year sentences. And just an incredible thirst for knowledge. And so, on one hand, being critical of what they've done, but also trying to look at the context. And I feel some of these workshops I've been doing help in a small way to people understand more what some of the causes of, you know, 2 million plus people in prisons, and disproportionately Black, particularly Black, but also Latino prisoners. So to me, it's been really, really rewarding work. I've learned a lot from doing it, and I feel I'm contributing what I can.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit more about the work that you've currently been doing? I know that it relates a lot to, you know, education, and that part of you being asked to come in had to do with kind of that background and having a lot of knowledge on, you know, political economy and things of that nature. So what is it kind of groups and curriculum are kind of going on inside that you're kind of helping to facilitate?
Okay, so very, very common. So usually we've had three or four people go, let's say, Clallam Bay, where we do maybe 2 days of workshops. So very common workshops where I've led would be either political economy of racism or ABCs of capitalism and socialism. So a common thing might be I would lead a discussion for maybe 2 hours on you know, what people think about how the economy works, what are some of the underlying problems, what are some of the limits of reform, and how, for example, racism and oppression of women fits into a capitalist economy, arguing that the inequality is very, you know, very much structured in the mm-hmm. economy, very much a class side, and some of the growth of inequality economically over the last 35 years. And there's a lot of receptivity too, that we talk about unions, their limits, a very interesting discussion, because many people, you know, they know they're going to get out eventually. We're going to have such a hard time finding jobs. So a lot of discussion about cooperatives, how people can form a cooperative where people work together, own business together, for example, like maybe a moving company, how they could do that in a somewhat just way and pay a living wage. We also talk a lot about reform, what are some of the reforms that are possible, particularly around prisoners, but also what how a longer-run solution of some kind of socialist, I call it participatory socialist society, where workers and communities would really coordinate society themselves. And again, there seems to be a lot of interest. I mean, often people have so limited access to discussing what are alternatives, what are possibilities. So it's a very, very rich discussion. We also have ones on social movements, on the whole prison system. We've done a few workshops on that, and they're very participatory. And again, I'm really impressed. I remember one, for example, it was at Coyote Ridge with a Latino group there, and the guards or the warden at first said that they didn't want people who were doing more than 10 years to be able to come because it wouldn't benefit them, and also that people who are called ICE holds, the ICE is Immigration Customs Enforcement, many people in prison who I've worked with, they have immigration holds, meaning they serve their time. Then they go to the Northwest Detention Center, which is near here, which I've visited many times. I know you've been in some of the protests around the private prison there. And then they get deported to Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras. Those are the people I've worked with. So we prisoners demanded that they be part of it. And people just so excited to be able to have that kind of a conversation. And, moreover, it seems to me from both what I've read plus being inside the prisons, that education, both getting degrees, whether it's high school, then college degrees, are both a value in itself, but also how people find jobs, reduce recidivism, so are really important. And so far, the programs I've done, we haven't been able to give credit for them. We just give people like a credential at the end, like political economy. But there also are attempts to form programs inside that would give either community college or even eventually four-year degrees. Evergreen, where I teach, Evergreen State College, a progressive public university in Olympia, Washington, is interested in developing programs inside the prisons for adults.
Right. So, Peter, this is kind of, before we get into maybe a larger analysis piece on political economy and how it relates, on the local level, again, economics, what does it mean, right? Is a lot of it has to do with access to resources, and we're talking about these very important, valuable resources inside and outside of the prison, but specifically inside for the prisoners. And you've mentioned already that there's this access piece. There's not a lot of access to these things, and if you can maybe just kind of address that. Not only why is that, I guess, but even just addressing, I mean, there's like this low frequency of these really positive things that are happening. They're happening and they're great, like what you're doing, but they're low frequency, and kind of what's going on there, and what does that say to you in your opinion, about kind of, budgets and how economics and neoliberal capitalism obviously kind of shaped this whole picture, but kind of focusing on Washington State and where you're going.
Okay, so I mean, I think both nationally, actually globally, and in Washington, we live in a neoliberal capitalist society, a society that is growingly unequal around economic terms, also with decreased mobility, meaning that people who come from families with, low incomes, particularly people of color, but also increasingly white families too, they have very limited access to decent jobs. Not that there's no mobility, but basically people are being programmed the way the society works for an unequal class society, an exploitative system where people have possibilities for the most part. They're from low-income backgrounds with low-wage jobs, no jobs, part-time work, what we call precariousness. And the prison population are a population that basically being discarded by a system that does not produce enough decent jobs, produces huge wealth for financial capital, the Googles and the Jeff Bezos and the Amazon.
Right.
But increasingly, for most people, they can't survive and live. And many of the people in prison, I think, did not accept that place in the bottom and rebelled, maybe not in the most socially productive way, but now in prison for a long time, with the keys basically being thrown away, these incredibly long sentences of people I'm working with. And so the prison system basically discards them. They're basically places that want to punish people, throw away the key, and not rehabilitate people. And even the programs in the past that, for example, would allow four-year Pell grants, that would allow money to be used for education, they almost don't exist. They're not zero, but basically they're very limited. So what I'm doing is nowhere near sufficient to what other people are doing, but it's an attempt to reach people who have this, like I said, thirst, both for, you know, education, but also just to, you know, learn about society, learn about themselves. So that's the purpose in a society that's incredibly unequal. And with, you know, the current administration, the Trump administration, even more cutting programs that could benefit working class and poor people. I mean, it's not just Trump. I mean, it certainly has been going on for a long time, but I think we are now even in a period of more overt racism, more blaming poor people, blaming people in prisons totally for the conditions they're in, as opposed to saying many of the causes of society that's based on a few people having, you know, most of the wealth.
For folks just tuning in, you've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, and this evening we are here with Dr. Peter Bomer, professor at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and he's currently working with prisoners around Washington State at different facilities doing educational programming. And again, Peter is a long time, very committed activist around a lot of different issues, international solidarity and environmental issues and what have you. And so, Peter, getting now into this kind of larger global piece of the analysis, we've talked a little bit about how does neoliberal capitalism affect this whole prison industrial complex. And again, we're under the duress of the Bozo the Clown Trump administration, right? And when we talk about global capitalism, we know that, you know very well, that the particular companies, you know, that have investments that are, you know, global. It's not just, you know, American companies or whatever that are making money off the prison system. And of course, there's this whole angle of talking about really prison slavery. And again, you know, it affects, you know, all kinds of different little political issues that come up. And I know you had a few things that you're kind of revved up about right now that kind of relate to that whole ball of wax. So do you want to kind of address some of those things and tease that out?
Okay. Yeah, so by neoliberal capitalism, probably most of the listeners are familiar with it, basically a capitalism that worships the market and believes, you know, in minimal taxes for rich people, and the idea, for example, that goods and capital, you know, money, finance can move across borders, but that people can't, right? An extreme version of it is a, you know, attempt by Trump to build a wall, but the whole growth of repression. And so we often hear about neoliberal capitalism as no government regulations. I think that's a little false. I think it's true that programs that meet people's needs are really being cut, such as the attempts, I think, right now to even cut Medicaid, food stamps, all those programs, which are insufficient, and maybe more insufficient in the United States than many other richer countries. And, you know, I often joke, but not fully, that, you know, the public housing under neoliberalism is basically the building of prisons, not building affordable housing for people. I mean, it's a crime of, you know, all the homeless people we see in Olympia, Portland, Seattle, both the cutting back of mental health facilities, affordable housing just being so increasingly absent. So prison becomes the public housing policy. There's been incredible growth of prison construction over the last basically 35 years since the late 70s.
Right.
And so that's the economy that we are living in. And I'm really concerned, because I've been active for many years, and you know, particularly one part that I've been really worried about. The United States is already fighting many undeclared wars, and there's really a kind of a weak anti-war movement now, but I'm really, you know, very, very worried with the appointments, example, of John Bolton to be the National Security Advisor, somebody who to me is really crazy, but respected, has pushed so hard for wars in the past against Cuba and Venezuela, both places I've taken classes to, with Iran, North Korea, the danger, and also Mike Pompeo, ex-head of the CIA, even more warlike than Tillerson, who's replacing as Secretary of State. To me, the need right now, we need to work with the issues of poverty, inequality, the racism at home, the whole gun craziness that's going on. But also, we have a responsibility in the United States to connect it, the issues of climate change, which is a global issue, but also the danger of war now. You know, I'm not just an alarmist person. I'm a very kind of hopeful person, but I'm really worried about war, even nuclear war, being started by the United States. For example, Bolton, who I mentioned, you know, has talked very openly, like in the Wall Street Journal about 4 weeks ago, about offensive war, attacking North Korea even before they make any attacks, you know, possible attacks, which I think is being exaggerated a little bit, as a way of preventing them from being able to defend themselves. And Iran, Bolton, and the other neoconservatives, who he was a major advisor in the Bush administration, George W. Bush, has talked about attacking Iran as long as they've talked of attacking Iraq, and he was one of the big proponents of the Iraq war. So I believe we're in a very, very serious position, again, not to scare people, but to say the importance of building movements, at least if there's enough protest resistance campaigns here, it might mean other people will, who have power too, will not favor the U.S. going to one more war. There are about 6 or 7 countries now bombing, attacking too, and I just hope that people can think of not only U.S. death, but any death around the world caused by the U.S. is equally, is equally horrible. So that's one issue I've been increasingly concerned about, you know, for a long time, but particularly in the last few months.
Right. Well, you know, on the show, Peter, you know, we really try to talk about the root causes of crime and understanding where this whole thing is coming from. And again, when we talk about the root causes of crime on this show, I mean, this is not a, you know, dry sociological analysis, right?
Right.
It's why are people have the quote-unquote criminal mind or, you know, some kind of these more mundane discussions, right? I mean, I think this is what we're talking about, is that root causes of crime, systemic poverty, we're supposed to be, you know, the most powerful, richest nation, blah, blah, blah. And then yet the first, you know, little write off for new expenditures, oh, we'll give another trillion to the military or whatever, and we're not taking care of anybody at home, and then that causes the communities to further, and of course on racial and ethnic lines too, right, get targeted and locked up, and so it's just becoming this bigger monster. So kind of bringing it back in a sense is like, you know, what do you think it takes, even for you know, maybe you know, you can give two pieces here. What does it take on the larger scale of things for things to really change, as far as transforming, you know, this whole prison industrial complex, right? That's a larger question. The kind of more narrow question, and we have a few minutes to tease these out for sure. The second part of the question, though, would be, like, let's say in Washington, you're doing this group, you know, a couple hours a month or something like that. But if we were going to sit down and kind of figure this out in a grant, you know, how many instructors do we need to facilitate the kind of education that really needs to happen inside? You know what I mean? So there's kind of two parts of that. You can address either one in okay. whatever order, good. You know.
Probably not in great detail, but, you know, on the first one, you know, we talked a few minutes ago about neoliberal capitalism. And to me, both the fear but also the opportunity. So the fear is, we've seen not just in the United States, but certainly in all over Europe, and also beyond that, with the kind of growing inequality, economic quality, so easy for politicians, but also the population, particularly the population, you know, the dominant population, say the white population here, kind of French Catholic population, Hungary, of blaming immigrants, blaming people who are part of the nation but not from the dominant ethnicity, blaming black people for the problems. We've had this really growth of right-wing nationalism I find really worrisome, even with fascist tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one possibility. On the other hand, things like the Sanders campaign, from pretty serious polls I've seen from Pew and others, the people under 30, African Americans as a whole, socialism is more popular than capitalism. And that, to me, is very, you know, a very positive development, even if what they mean by socialism, which I'll get to in a minute, a really an economy not based on production for profit, but, you know, where production is owned socially. Even if they don't mean that, they mean more like a social democratic system like Scandinavia, that people are so open to that is, to me, a real possibility and really a necessity. I haven't even talked about climate change, but if we're going to survive, we need a socially, I call it just for a socialism economy based on production for need, where communities, workers control how production is organized to meet human needs, a lot of social consumption rather than just private consumption, and with jobs that are more meaningful. To me, that's so necessary. If the planet's going to survive, we can live with dignity. We have the possibilities of that, but we don't have the organization to make that a reality. And of course, there's going to be resistance by the wealthy, but if we can organize, I do believe that's really a necessity. You know, we need a different system, but it's both needed and, to me, possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. And certainly the United States solution has been just locking more and more people up. And I do think it's very, very worrisome with the kind of militarization of the police, militarization of the border. So again, I think to build movements where the population can see the problems, this is incredibly unjust, destructive, unequal capitalist system, rather than blaming poor people, blaming prisoners, blaming immigrants, blaming black people, Native Americans. To me, that's the task that we have in front of us. And to me, the education of people in prison as well as, you know, outside is so important. I don't mean school. I mean really people learning from each other about
right.
what kind of society we want, what the causes are. So that's, I see as one important work. I call it popular education mm-hmm. that we need to be involved in. And one last thing, I guess the society as a whole, that's not what's being provided, neither in the public school system. But to me, these the vouchers, the privatization of schools is another way some people can make profit. It's not a solution at all. But also, to me, it's so important that we include, whether we're talking about health care, education, we include immigrants, documented, undocumented, we include prisoners also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember Ho Chi Minh, the leader of the Vietnamese Revolution, saying, you know, when the prison doors open, the real dragon will fly out. And I'm saying not what Manassas in prison. There's a lot of people who are in prison because they were dealt very bad cards. And to develop movements that can include prisoners, both political and people like I think I mentioned before, who've become politicized inside, to me is a responsibility of all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, there's that whole deficit of what needs to happen inside while we have this prison industrial complex, this mass incarceration system in America, because, you know, it's not going to change overnight. We know that. But while we're trying to do that work from the outside and inside, what are the things, and we just have, you know, kind of a minute or two to address right. that before we close, but just again, with you going inside, I mean, what do you see that needs to be expanded? Obviously, we need more people doing more of this.
So one, I think, Adam, is that, in fact, these, you know, really good questions, is there's really a lot of intelligence and wisdom inside, so it's not people on the outside like me or you just doing things for people. It's really listening to people inside. A second, you know, so that's one thing. I think a second thing is really pushing for these just draconian sentences. They push down a lot of people I'm working with. You know, I said they did some very serious crimes. They're very young. Pushing that parole, for example, you know, whether we say 5 years, 10 years, that people be eligible for parole at a limited time. So that's the second thing, pushing for more reasonable sentences, having resentencing of people who've got these crazy sentences when they're very, very young. Thirdly, I think, you know, improving like health care both inside prisons and out. And when I say prisons, I include the immigration prisons. I think those are prisons we sometimes forget about. Having prisoners be about when people transition out, where they could be eligible to go to college, where they'd be accepting that, where people wouldn't be held against them, they were in prison, which to me seems very, very important also. So those are just a few things that seem to be really necessary, decreasing prison construction also, because, and then finally, like I said earlier, seeing political prisoners as part of whatever group does is part of our work, like the way you're doing it.
Right, right. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Want to thank our guest, Peter Bomer. Peter, we need you so much in the movement. So honored to have you on the show and just happy that you're around helping us think all this stuff out. We're just scratching the surface, but we'll hope to have you again. And thanks to our wonderful engineer, Michael Fictalis. Have a great evening. Free them all. We'll see you next week.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Word's Alive Tour on Thursday, April 5th, 7 p.m. at Specs Records and Tapes, 8216 North Denver Avenue in Portland. This in-store performance by One Word for his Alive Spring Tour will be followed by several sets from local hip-hop support, Lisa Vasquez, Burt Sienna, Valvoline, and Northern Draw. This is an all-ages show, again, all ages. That's One Word's Alive Tour at Specs Records, 8216 North Denver Avenue in Portland.